Book of the Week with Claire Armistead on guardian.co.uk.
Hello. We're now in the middle of Jewish Book Week, one of London's most cosmopolitan festivals, which has brought writers pouring in from around the world. But is there such a thing as Jewish literature? We'll be debating this with the writer Jonathan Safran Foer. We'll be interviewing Amy Bloom about her new short story collection, and we'll talk to Israel's most translated author and surely Nobel laureate in waiting, Amos Oz. But first, here's a taster of Oz's new book-length fable, Suddenly in the Depths of the Forest.
The village was grey and gloomy. Around it on all sides were only mountains and forests, clouds and wind. There were no other villages nearby. Visitors almost never came to that village, and passers-by never stopped there. 30 or 40 small houses were scattered on the slope of the valley, enclosed by towering mountains. The one pass through the mountains was on the western side, and the only road to the village was through that pass. But it didn't go any further because there was no further. The world ended there. Once in a great while, a travelling tradesman or peddler, and sometimes just a beggar who had lost his way, would come to the village. But no wanderer ever stayed longer than 2 nights, because the village was cursed. It was always eerily silent. No cow mooed, no donkey brayed, no bird chirped, no flock of geese crossed the empty sky, and the villagers barely spoke to each other beyond the essential things. Only the sound of the river could be heard constantly, day and night, because a powerful river rushed through the mountain forests. It passed through the village, white foam on its banks, frothing, seething and bubbling with a low roar, until it was swallowed up again in the bends of the valley and the forest. At night, the silence was even blacker and thicker than in the daytime. No dog stretched its neck and flattened its ears to howl at the moon. No fox whined in the forest. No night bird shrieked. No cricket chirped. No frog croaked. No rooster crowed at dawn. All the animals had disappeared from the village and its surroundings many years ago. Cows and horses and sheep, geese and cats and nightingales, dogs and spiders and rabbits. There wasn't even one small goldfinch. Not a fish was left in the river. Storks and cranes bypassed the narrow valley on their journeys of migration. Even bugs and reptiles, bees, flies, ants, worms, mosquitoes, moths, hadn't been seen for many a year. The grown-ups who still remembered usually chose to stay silent, to deny, to pretend they'd forgotten.
Chris Moran reading from Suddenly in the Depths of the Forest. Oz is not actually appearing at Jewish Book Week this year, but he has done so before. Sarah Crown managed to catch him in a rare visit to the UK to publicise his new book. She asked him what prompted him to leave Israel for the setting of this story and turn instead to European myths and legends.
When I was a little boy, my mother used to tell me fairy tales and bedtime stories, who were all located in thick woods, in forests, near springs and rivers, in a landscape which is very different than the arid landscape of Israel. So for me, this forest and mountain and stream, these are the landscapes of the legends and the fairy tales.
And what moved you at this point in your career to want to tell a legend, to write the story of a legend?
Well, it all began with a bedtime story which I told to my grandchildren some 10 years ago when they were still very small, and I had to tell a sequence of chapters, a chapter each night, and I invented them as I told them. So I told them a story which is essentially a story about exclusion and about courage and about integrity.
You say in your memoir, you a couple of times make the point that there is a difference between the facts of a situation and the truth of it. And so the facts of this story, as you read them from the page, are about this village where the animals have disappeared and the children, these two children, are going to try and find them. Is that the same as the truth of it? What's the truth of the story to you? Is that about this idea of courage and integrity?
It's about someone who have been excluded and about the exclusion of the animals and about the exclusion of others, the outsiders. And it's about the courage of Maya and Mati, who dare to go and seek the mystery and try to find out what is behind all the clues and the hints and the echoes which they can receive in the air.
You're known as a political author, among other things, but you've in the past you've said that you're quite impatient with the idea of direct allegory, that, you know, that sometimes a mother is just a mother and not the nation, that kind of thing. But fairy tales are so closely bound up with the idea of allegory. Does that concern you? Does it bother you that people will be looking for the allegory in this story?
Well, I'm philosophical about it. People will be looking into allegory in everything that comes from a troubled part of the world, be it the Middle East or Latin America or South Africa. People always look for some statement in disguise, some statement about the state of the nation in disguise. This story, this fairy tale, is not meant as an allegory, and it's not meant as a statement about the state of the nation. It's more about the human condition in general.
I wanted to ask you, there's a line at the end of your novel, Rhyming Life and Death, which I think you actually wrote after Suddenly in the Depths of the Forest. Obviously, this book, this is a novel for adults, and it's an investigation of the process of imagination. And the line that I'm thinking of reads, "Once in a while, it's worth turning on the light to clarify what's going on." And you said in an interview, "If I had to describe in the simplest of words the purpose of my writing, these would be the words." Could you tell me how those words you think relate to this book?
Well, very simple. I have experienced exclusion when I was a little boy. I have seen exclusion around me. I have been at the receiving end of exclusion, and all my life I wanted to write a story which will describe the consequences of exclusion and how exclusion may poison the entire excluding society. So I looked at this imaginary village and in this fictitious forest and in this fictitious mountain, and I placed my story about exclusion and the animals in this imaginary landscape.
You said in your memoir also that you wanted to grow up to be not a writer, but a book. The idea being that a book is a safe thing, that it can't be threatened by external forces, it keeps existing. Is this the kind of book you'd have liked to have been? Is this a safe story, do you think?
This is the kind of book I would like to be remembered by.
Why is that?
Because, in a sense, it has about it what I call a second simplicity. There are the simple stories with simple morale about losing something, finding something, looking for something. Above them come the complex stories, the stories with complicated plot and complicated character and complicated intrigue. And further above the complex stories comes stories which have in them about them second simplicity, stories which on the surface look very simple, but in fact they engulf an entire world of emotions and feelings and fears and apprehensions and hopes.
Which fairy tales are your favourite from your own childhood?
The Grimm stories of the Brothers Grimm.
Yes, and there are really strong echoes of that kind of gnarled, tangled landscape here. Just a final question, a more general question. Your name is mentioned very regularly now as a possibility for the Nobel laureateship, and this is an honour that's only ever been given to one Israeli author beforehand, S.Y. Agnon, whom you knew, I think, slightly as a child and a young man.
Yes.
Is it an honour that you'd welcome? Would it make you proud to follow in his footsteps?
Yes, I'll be very proud if I ever get the Nobel Prize, but I assure you that if I don't get it, I'm not going to die an unhappy man.
That was Sarah Crown talking to Amos Oz. She joins me here in the studio along with the novelist Jonathan Safran Foer, whose most recent book is a polemic against eating meat. Welcome, both of you. Jonathan, you appeared at Jewish Book Week on Monday alongside the Israeli novelist Edgar Keret in a session entitled, with a nod to your second novel, Extremely Bad and Incredibly Cruel. It posed such pressing questions as, could vegetarianism be the new Kath Root? Are you a polemicist now as well as a novelist? Was I wrong to describe you as a novelist?
No, you're right to describe me as a novelist, I hope. I don't feel like a polemicist, and I don't think of that book, Eating Animals, as an argument against meat per se, even though it probably feels like it comes very close to being that.
Now, and we're not actually here to debate the morals of meat. We're here to talk literature, and in particular to ask you, is there such a thing as a Jewish novel?
That sounds like a simple question, but it's a very complicated one. The question that would naturally come right before it is there such a thing as a Jewish novelist? And that's a question I'm asked quite often. Do I think of myself as a Jewish novelist, as if anyone thinks of himself at all, unless he or she is asked to? But, you know, I'm Jewish. I don't practice the Jewish religion except when I'm compelled to by guilt most often, or by some sort of change in life like a marriage or birth of a child. But I do associate, I feel very strongly culturally Jewish, and I, of course, am a writer. So to say that I'm not a Jewish writer would require some linguistic or intellectual contortions. Mm. Is there such a thing as a Jewish novel? It's slightly different than asking if there's such a thing as a Jewish writer. You know, Aretha Franklin is a black singer. Is Respect a black song? I don't know. My writing probably does flow from some Jewish tradition. That was probably unavoidable given the kinds of books I read as a child, that I was given to read by my parents, by my grandmother, the kinds of jokes we told, the tone of our dinner table conversations had a Jewish flavor, recognizably Jewish flavor. And a lot of things have surprised me since I've become a writer, but nothing has surprised me more than how Jewish my writing is. Mm. I would not have anticipated it. Mm. I would not have chosen it, actually. But, you know, it's like the bloody glove at the end of a murder trial. Where it doesn't really matter what the defendant has said the whole time. When the prosecutor holds up that bloody glove, you say, well, I guess he did it. And my books for me are like bloody gloves at the end of a trial, where, you know, if you'd asked me, do I feel particularly Jewish before writing the books, I would have said no. And looking at the books, I feel like...
There's the bloody glove.
There's the bloody glove.
I was twittering this actually earlier this afternoon because I was a bit worried about tackling such a big subject. And Michael Rosen, the writer, came back to us saying, possible argument is to be made for US Jewish literature or British Jewish literature, but hybridity must be encompassed. Sarah, what do you think of that?
Jewish literature and American literature in the 20th century have certainly seemed to go hand in glove, to expand on your glove metaphor. In literary terms, the 20th century was the American century without question. And the sort of dominating voices of that century have been the likes of Philip Roth and Saul Bellow, huge sort of colossi on the literary landscape in the States. And obviously also both Jewish, and you also have E.L. Doctorow as well to sort of throw into the mix. And so this sort of New York Jewishness, I suppose, has informed everything that we think about when we think about American literature. In Britain, it does seem to me to be less of a thing, although there are obviously sort of British Jewish writers, Bernice Rubens perhaps, most obviously, and Howard Jacobson. Mm. But I think it is a stronger, more vigorous, more potent, more interesting tradition within American literature perhaps than it is in British literature.
I have wondered about this difference between Jewish American writers and English American writers, and if someone like a Howard Jacobson had been born in the States and written precisely the same books, if we would now be talking about Bellow, Roth, and Jacobson. Yes. He's a writer I really admire tremendously. There's a point at which the literary question morphs into a political question.
Absolutely, in the sense that the sort of the Jewish voice is also the immigrant voice in the 20th century in America, and America was the land of immigration, and so it ties in precisely with America's sense of itself and its sort of developing sense of itself. To have, you know, the Jewish novel becomes the American novel, and they sort of blend together.
I wondered, there's another whole side apart from these sort of big male agonized figures, which is the sort of fabulist side, which comes up a lot in your writing, doesn't it? Everything is illuminated, has one side of it is in this sort of semi-mythical, in literary terms, thing, the shtetl.
Well, we didn't mention Isaac Bashevis Singer in the list, which is odd, as he's two-thirds of the Jewish Nobel Prizes in the second half of the century. And that is certainly part of the Jewish literary tradition, not only literary but artistic tradition, in the visual arts and in music, a kind of flamboyancy or whatever the opposite of repression is. And it's not a coincidence that it's the opposite of repression, because repression is something else that Jews have become sort of, I don't know, famous for in the second half of the 20th century. It was after the war that Jews became funny or recognized as being humorous, and became recognized as being sort of flamboyantly comic, and also became really that the Jewish American literary tradition began. And it's hard not to say that they weren't all those three things that I mentioned weren't responses to the trauma of the war. And something that Roth in particular writes an awful lot about is the inability to communicate certain things in life. And that was I took lessons from him as a writer, because I experienced very much the same kinds of things, that when there's an awful lot not to talk about but a strong energy or desire to express, you find other vehicles for expression than, the dinner table conversations. And I think that literature has been the real vehicle for the opposite of repression in Jewish
America. But it finds an allegorical outlet.
Well, in my writing, it has. In Roth's writing, it sometimes has. I mean, Roth has now written so many books that, if you name something, he's done it at one point or another. But, when my first novel came out, people said it was very Chagall-esque. And I think that's what they were referring to. Chagall is not a favorite painter of mine. But the kind of folklorization of Eastern Europe, or the kind of magical realist quality. That's not really what I was trying to do. It's not that important to me. What was important to me in that book is what happens when what we imagine has to confront what is. And in the case of, World War II, or rather growing up in the wake of it, there's so many different kinds of absences. There are very literal absences, people who aren't there. And there are also the absence of stories. It was just something we didn't talk about ever. And in an effort to fill those absences, I created some very flamboyant things. Maybe that was a kind of act of revenge against the silence, or maybe it was just the shape my imagination naturally wanted to take. But the conflict, the climax of the book is not when the Nazis overrun this village. It's when the imagination has to confront reality, and this book or this world that the character Jonathan is imagining confronts the reality that Alex, the hero, has presented to him. This past week, I had an essay published about this trauma that I experienced when I was a kid. And I never thought about writing novels that were in response to that. But when I look at my two novels, I even look at the titles of them, they seem very directly related to this event.
Mm. And which, of course, brings us to the big trauma, central trauma, arguably, of the 20th century, the Holocaust. Sarah.
Yes, we had a blog on the site this week from Toby Lichtig, connected to Jewish Book Week, actually, when he was looking at the programme for Jewish Book Week, and saying that one thing that was very interesting about it was that the Holocaust as a subject had slightly drifted to the side, and there were books on everything else, sort of the meat industry and books for children and anything else that you could think of, and only a few books on the Holocaust where for such a long time it had been absolutely the central subject. And his position was that perhaps as the people who experienced the Holocaust begin to age and die, as a race, as a world, we are moving on from it in one sense or another. And although obviously kind of in a sort of an intellectual sense and an emotional sense, it's always going to inform literature, Jewish literature, all literature probably, on some level. As the sort of the primary subject, it might sort of drift to the side. And I was thinking about that you see this, or you could sort of take as an example of this, Michael Chabon's work, going from The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, which is all about the Holocaust, the effects of the Holocaust and you know, Nazis fighting Jews in comic books, to the Yiddish Policeman's Union, which is set in sort of a bit of America that's been given to the Jews, and it's an imaginative excursion into a sort of an alternative history. And so he's moving away from experiences to consequences, and perhaps this is something that we might see happening more as the Holocaust sort of moves away from us in history.
Well, now I would take issue with some part of that, because firstly, what Jonathan was saying about the absences and the inability to tell the stories. And secondly, modern publishing, it seems to me, is picking up on all these stories that have been there and they're being published. People like Irene Nemirovsky, Stefan Zweig, these voices are only now being heard, having lain dormant for 40 years. So I think there's a paradox there.
Yeah,
there's
a give and take, perhaps. But
I don't know. It's very hard to know what is happening in the present moment. What we could say is if there is a movement away from it, that's probably a good thing. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that even still in America, the Holocaust joke is really taboo. Of course, writers do it sometimes or comedians do it, but it's not mainstreamed. And that suggests we're not over it yet. You know, it's not an event that's in the past. It's not an event that we want to say we are reconciled with.
What about Jewish writers from other parts of the world? I mean, you were on the stage with Edgar Keret, very interesting writer, writes in Hebrew.
Well, Israel has amazing literature right now. David Grossman is Amasaz, Yehuda Amachai. My second child's middle name is Amachai. He was as important to me as any writer has been. And, we've now mentioned Jacobson twice, but I would bring him up again. I think he's a real giant, like a great, great writer. And for whatever reasons, it seems like his stars haven't quite aligned in the States in terms of finding a broad readership, but I certainly hope that it happens.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, have you got any advance notice from other parts of the world?
I mentioned earlier Bernice Rubens, who's a Welsh Jewish. Apparently her father, when he was on the boat, he was cheated by the ticket touts and they chucked him off the boat at Cardiff, and he thought for 2 weeks that he was in New York before he realised that in fact
New York, then.
That
Cardiff
in fact
was
he wasn't
New York.
Yeah. and so they settled in Wales, and her Jewishness was at the heart of her writing. She said that everything that happens in a family is more so in a Jewish family, and sort of the familial and the Jewish were the kind of central themes of her writing.
This is the first woman writer we have mentioned in this whole podcast.
Yes,
I'd like to
point
out
we could have mentioned many. We could have mentioned Susan
so why did
Sontag,
we not?
Cynthia Ozick.
Grace Paley.
Yeah. Is it because, do we not, because they don't trumpet themselves so much as Jewish writers?
We don't, unfortunately, because we don't mention women writers as often as we mention male writers. I don't think Judaism actually has anything to do with it in this case.
Yeah. I would certainly, in this context, mention Zoe Hellas, The Believers, and Naomi Alderman. Have you come across Naomi Alderman yet? Who wrote a very interesting book about looking inside the Orthodox community, which is something that it just doesn't often get opened up at all.
Yeah, apparently it was the first book about the British Orthodox Jewish community since Daniel Deronda, which is maybe 130 years beforehand, so yes, certainly not something we talk about a lot.
And that was Disobedience.
Yes.
Yeah. Now to a writer whose stature is becoming increasingly canonical, Amy Bloom, whose arrival as part of Jewish Book Week coincides with the publication of her latest collection of short stories, Where the God of Love Hangs Out. I say it's short stories, and it is, but it does include two sections of linked stories. Sarah began by asking what advantages this particular form gives to writers.
I don't know that it gives you any advantages in particular. I think for the two quartets, I suppose if there's an advantage, it's that without engaging in an entire novel, I get to cover 20 or 30 years and a wide range of characters and a lot of movement. And I get to link the pieces together in a way that's a different kind of connective tissue than what you require for a novel. So for me, it was sort of the best of both worlds. It was more depth, more breadth, but I didn't have to do it for 4 years.
Yeah, and there's one of the things that interests me most as a reader in a formal sense was that one thing that you get to do is shift perspective. So you've got, in the second set of linked stories, the two central characters are Julia and Lionel. And one story to tell from her perspective, one from his, one that's in the third person, and that it's like moving around the scene, I suppose, as from the reader's point of view, you get to kind of look in at different windows.
Well, I think that is one of the real pleasures of it, and you can do that in a novel as well, but being able to move between two different first persons, although people often do that in novels as well, I often find kind of clunky. And yeah. So being able to do it in the Link short story seemed very smooth.
And yes, there's no sense that it's disallowed in any way. It's you're starting another piece and you get it from a different perspective.
Right. And it was a pleasure to put those things together, as it was with William and Claire, you know, in which you see things from his point of view, from her point of view, you know, from God's point of view.
Yeah. And these different characters that you have, although they are, you know, they're from different backgrounds, some of them are men, some of them are women, but I felt that as I was reading the collection, there was a sort of a tonal similarity between them. And I wondered whether, you know, they happened sort of through your imagination, you thought, yes, this is one of my characters, this is somebody who I can write about. Or what was it that drew you to them?
I think lots of things drive me towards different characters. I mean, I would say, for example, the girl in Permafrost does not have much in common with the people in Julia and Lionel's family. Mm. You know, it isn't necessarily a particular quality of articulation or this kind of preference or that kind of preference. It's more the piece in them that resonates with something that I can develop into a narrative. I tend not to write stupid characters. That's true, because I don't find them very interesting to me as storytellers. But that's, I think, the only thing they all have in common.
And you write a lot about transgressive love in this collection. I guess if there's a theme to it, it would seem to be that. You know, the first set of the first quartet that you mentioned, that's about two married people falling in love, and perhaps more unusually, it's about two older married people falling in love with each other. And then in the second quartet, I don't really want to give anything away to readers who haven't read the collection yet, but there is you write about an even more obviously transgressive form of love. What was it about that made you want you choose it as a subject?
I suspect that most forms of love, in fact, are a little transgressive. We just don't tend to dwell on it. You know, you're not going to see any headlines that says, mother of newborn ignores husband. You know, it's like, uh-huh. You know, love does not always embrace everybody equally and happily, exactly the way they would like. Love is very rarely convenient and cozy.
Is that why it's the subject that writers keep returning to?
There are only a few things to write about. You cannot write a really fascinating novel about somebody going to the grocery store, having just the right coupons, and making a nice roast at the end of the day. No one wants to read that book. People have to fall in love, they have to have sex, they have to die, and bad shit has to happen.
But these are, by and large, stories that kind of exist in the domestic sphere. They're quite sort of small scale. They're about people's daily lives. Even if it's the unusual things that happen within those daily lives. And there was a big hoo-ha in the UK a couple of years back about the idea that women generally write about the domestic sphere and the suggestion that this was problematic. Does it feel problematic to you?
I don't know. Didn't that hurt Jonathan Franzen's feelings and Philip Ross and well, Henry James?
Gosh, of course there was a bit of comeback.
I can only conclude when people have those conversations that they just have way too much time on their hands. You know, I mean, who are we comparing? You know, Pat Barker to Henry James? What's the conversation here? Mm. If the assumption is that women tend to be more interested in the domestic because they're more intimately acquainted with the laundry room, that's certainly possibly true. But I don't think that has much bearing on anything. I do think the ideas of masculinity and femininity are interesting. They just don't tend to have anything to do with the person's actual gender.
Mm. And it seems, you know, sort of to continue with the gender idea a little bit, although in a slightly different way, we've seen a lot of interest in short stories in particular by women in the last few years. Alice Munro winning the International Man Booker. And we have new collections over here in the UK from Helen Simpson, who's an amazing short story writer. Mayla Malloy has brought out a new collection. You yourself, obviously, and various others. And I wondered whether you had any idea why the short form, or why you personally choose the short form to write to? Obviously, you've written novels, but what it is about it that is appealing?
I mean, I think liking to write short stories is a fairly quirky thing. I do like writing novels as well. The book I'm working on now is a novel. I think that there are two things. One is everybody who comes out of an MFA program anywhere in the modern world is going to have a short story collection, because that's what people learn to write in MFA programs by and large, because it's more manageable to workshop it. So you have an enormous number of people who are just producing them. So with any luck, there will be a certain number of those that are really good, and that sort of creates more of a groundswell. I think for me, I love them because they exist for me somewhere between a poem and a novel. And a really good short story is a very hard thing to write. It's also true that a pretty good short story is not that hard to write if you're a good writer. You can get away with voice and description and a character sketch. But a really good short story is incredibly demanding, and there's no room for self-indulgence, and there's no room for riffs, and there's no room for a lot of blah, blah, blah. Here are my clever thoughts on the history of rice. You know, you have to serve the story and serve the characters and say what you mean and create an ending that has some kind of resonance. So I love the demands of the short story.
Amy Bloom. Where the God of Love Hangs Out is published by Granta this week and is reviewed in The Observer on Sunday. And that's it for today's podcast. Thanks to Jonathan Safran-Foer, Amy Bloom, Amos Oz and Sarah Crown. Jonathan's book Eating Animals is published by Hamish Hamilton and is reviewed in the Guardian Saturday Review this weekend, alongside the first of John Mullen's Guardian Book Club columns on Everything is Illuminated. We'll also be profiling Ian McEwan, and David Hare will be reviewing Andrew Rawnsley's The End of the Party. On Sunday, the new expanded Observer Review will feature a big interview with Dave Eggers and will give its verdict on Amy Bloom. Jewish Book Week continues throughout the weekend. You can find out more about it on www.jewishbookweek.com. I'm Claire Armistead, and the producer is Scott Crawley. Until next week, goodbye.